Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's December 7th, 2012. You're listening to the best poker cast on the planet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm horse champion Scott Long. See how long I can get away with that.
I gotta tell you, it was a little bit in my craw that you pulled down a title and that people are emailing us and Facebooking us and tweeting us saying, oh, now the intro of the show, you can say one guy who doesn't know how to play poker and the other guy who can back it up, I said, all right, you know what, I'm gonna go to this holiday charity classic and like I do every year, and I'm going to take this bad boy down, so I am very, very happy to announce that, Scott, I won.
Did you really?
Yes, yes. I won a toaster.
Yes! Awesome. That is awesome.
You know, we're sitting there at the table, and by the way, our columnist and good friend and Ante Up National, Lee Childs, was in this tournament. He was there the day before, as we had mentioned on the show, too, doing some of his classes and things like that, and another tournament as well. So he was there, and I was like, oh, I really want to play at Lee's table. I want to have fun over there and you know, bust his chops and blah, blah, blah. So after the first table broke, sure enough, I get moved to his table. So that was kind of cool. So we were sitting there, we're playing, and the great rabbi comes over, a guy, just fantastic gentleman, came over to the table, as he does throughout the entire charity event, and his signature one too, the Venetian Deep Stack one that he does. And he comes over to the table and he's like, so who here likes grilled cheeses? So this is like right in the middle of the tournament, everybody's playing, we're like, so Lee and I and a couple other people, we raise our hand, and he's like, wow, five people at this table like grilled cheeses? Because when I was a kid, I loved grilled cheeses. So here's what we're going to do. He goes, eeny, meeny, miny, moe, and he starts going off our heads, you know. And it ends up Y-O-U, and he lands on me, and I win a toaster. So I'm like, horse title, toaster in a charity event. I think I'll take the toaster. So it was a great, great day, a lot of fun. I win the toaster, and at the end of the night, you know, the rabbi is still giving away things. He goes to Lee's table and does a random thing, and Lee wins a hand mixer.
Wow.
We basically had every kitchen, you know, utensil or whatever you want to call it. Appliance. It was great. It was a lot of fun. A great tournament. Almost 300 players played in it. Funny thing is, you know, when I go, the best part about it for me is always seeing all of the people that, you know, we see whenever we go there, or a lot of our cruisers come from that area. So I know I saw Jim and Lorraine and Neil and Don and Nikki. And Nikki was there, and she played the tournament, and she's one of our cruisers that we've talked about on the show before. And as I'm walking out, Nikki is playing in a cash game. She's like, oh, Chris, you got knocked out. And I'm like, yeah, you know. But, and you know, ultimately,
don't cry for me, Nikki. I got a toaster.
I got a toaster. She's like, what is that? I go, it's a toaster. She goes, oh, my God, I need a toaster. I said,
oh, no.
I said, what? You don't need a toaster. She goes, yeah, I need a toaster.
Maybe she likes grilled cheeses.
I said, okay, make me an offer. She goes, $30. I said, $30? That's too much. She goes, all right, $25. I said, sold. So I sold the toaster, which probably goes for $8-$10. I don't know. I have no idea what toasters cost, but I sold it for $25. I was so excited. But I was more excited the fact that I did cash in the tournament, so that felt pretty good. Not as good as winning a horse tournament, but I was doing it for charity, so that made me feel pretty good. And I donated a bunch of money to charity. I tipped everybody a lot of money out of it. And I just felt really good. It was a real good day. I had a lot of fun with all those people, and a lot of interesting stories came out of it. I thought I would share a few of them with you. On the first break, I thought some weird things happened during the day. On the first break, I walked by a guy who had a royal flush tattooed on his face.
Awesome.
A real, real tattoo, not like, you know.
Right, not one of the 10 of ones that you get at the theme park.
Yeah, yeah. No, real, real. I mean, it was like hearts or something. And the other thing, too, is he may have had it on both sides of his face. I can't remember because I saw him twice during the day, and I saw only that side of him, so I couldn't remember if I saw the left side and then the right side or whatever. So he may have had both cheeks, like, just, you know, emblazoned with this tattoo. But
you know, you always have the best hand. The worst you can do is chop every pot. The worst you can do.
It was funny. Like I said, I mentioned earlier that I got to join Lee's table. It was a lot of fun. I had position on him, so that was kind of cool. And it was funny. He was tweeting about me as I was sitting at his table. He had no idea I was coming to sit next to him. And he was tweeting about, you know, that he was at the tournament and that I was there, and he was busting my chops saying I like milk and everything. And but I sat down about four seats to his left, and there was one guy in the middle who had a massive stack. And as soon as I sat down at the table, a lady to my left said, "Yeah, that guy, he's been hitting everything. He's really good." So it took me a few hands, but I realized this guy wasn't very good, and everyone at the table was intimidated, other than Lee. Everyone was intimidated by this guy. So I said, "I'm going to target this dude." And you could tell Lee was going to target him too. And he had a massive stack. And there was one hand where I got it all in with him. I had ace king, and he had ace 10. And it went, Lee raised. The guy called, I re-raised with ace-king, Lee folded, and then the guy re-raised me, and I knew that for his range all day, I knew that there was no way that he was going to have ace-king beat, and if he did, I was probably racing him. So I shoved, and he called with like very little left. It was a 60K pot, and the blinds were 200-400.
Oh my gosh.
And of course, he had ace-10, didn't hold up, and I devastated him, and then he built the stack back up, and then Lee took him for everything a few hands later after that. It was just remarkable. Between the two of us, we just annihilated him, and basically used those chips to go on to the final 20. Well, I finished 27th. I'm not sure where Lee finished.
He said he finished 10th.
Yeah, well, I thought he made the final table, or I wasn't sure. So yeah, he went pretty far. It was funny, because at the end of the night, Lee had like 30,000, and I had like 70,000. He's like, "Well, I'm all in, and you want to have a last shorter bet?" And I started laughing. He had queen three, and he went up against ace queen, and he won.
Wow.
And then I had pocket tens and went up against pocket kings and lost. So I went out 27th. He went out 10th. So I think he gets like oil changes for life if he wants to drive down to Daytona. You know, because he always has. The rabbi always has unique gifts, you know, on top of the money he won. He won some money, too, obviously. But it was really cool. And I'll never forget, when we got to the bubble, he comes around with this cool World Series jacket. And he's like, "The bubble person wins this jacket." And I'm like, "Yes, no matter what now, I have a toaster, and I could win this jacket." So it's not a losing, you know, I feel really good. And, of course, I didn't go out in the bubble. I went out about four spots later, and I won money. And it felt really good. It felt good to donate. They had a really unique way of doing things. They had these sort of buckets or bins and a bunch of charities on hand. So, you know, disabled children, hunger, you know, food bank, things like that. And you could pick. See, it was a bounty tournament. I forgot that. It was a bounty tournament. So when you knock somebody out, you got, like, $10. But then you also got a blue chip or a blue ticket. And the ticket was worth $10 that you had to, you know, choose a charity you wanted to give it to. If you didn't...
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it was. It was really cool. And if you forgot, you know, if you put the paper in your pocket and left or whatever, they would just take the money that's left over and donate it equally or whatever. But you, as the donor, you know, the person got to choose what you wanted. So it was. I felt really good. I mean, I knocked out like five or six people during a tournament. So I donated like $60. And then after I cashed, I walked by them again, put some cash in. It just felt really good. It was a really great tournament, a lot of fun. And like he always does, you know, the rabbi is always so energetic, and he gave a bunch of stuff away. And I had one hand, though, I wanted to talk about, and that was it. And then there was one other small thing that happened. But I really felt like, you know, okay, I drove over. You know, I want to make it worth my while here. But I was short, and pretty early on at the first table, I had a king queen and I had raised and I got called by someone in out of position and they had ace queen and a queen came. So I lost a bunch there. I lost about a third of my stack. So a guy on my left who was a cruiser, his name was Don, he raised basically under the gun because I was a big blind. And the person to his left called the raise. We had one other caller, and then it came back to me. This was pretty early on, so I would say it could have been probably 50 and 100, you know, around there maybe, as blinds. So it gets back to me in the big blind, and I have 6-9 of diamonds. So I wanted to say that, you know, we're playing at a dog track, and it was like dog day afternoon there. Everybody could bring their dogs. It was like a
awesome.
It was like the same day as, you know, they held this charity tournament the same day as, like, I don't know, bring your dog to the track day or something. I mean, every kind of dog you could think of was
Park in the park.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. And so I'm looking at 6-9, and I think to myself, wow, that's a dog of a hand. And I thought, well, wait a minute. Today it's a dog day.
It's not of a dog of a hand, it's canine.
That's right. If it was king nine, it'd be the canine hand, but it was 6-9. So I thought, all right, you know what? I'm going to play this hand because I don't have to play that much. Maybe I can get it in, double up, and if not, I'll go home early and still spend my Sunday watching the Packers beat the Vikings or something. I don't know. So I called a raise. It wasn't that much, really, because by the time it got to me, it was like I was getting like 6-1 of my money or something. So I said, what the hell? So I have 6-9 of diamonds, and it comes ace of diamonds, 3 of diamonds, 9 of clubs. So I'm like, okay, I got a flush draw and middle pair. I know the guy to my left is going to bet out. He's been betting out every time he's raised, whether he has ace-king or not. He's going to bet here, I know it. So I'm going to check raise. So he bets, and then the guy to his left calls, and then the other guy folded. So now it's on me, and I'm like, you know what? All my children. So if I put it all in here, if they only have one pair, can they really call? And if they do, that's okay, because I have a pair, I can hit another 9, maybe my 6, and of course the diamonds. So I'm like, this is a good place to just get it all in. And like I said, if I don't win, I go home. So he thinks forever and then calls. So I'm like, all right, well, I'm going to have to hit now, I guess. And then the guy on his left instantly called. I'm like, holy cow, I got to be up against, like, another flush draw, and now I need to hit, like, a 9, and I'm probably up against ace-king. Well, the guy on my left, the cruiser, Don, he had ace-queen, and the guy on his left had ace-king.
Oh, my gosh.
Really? So I'm like, holy cow, I better hit a diamond now. So Don, as the dealer's getting ready to wrap the table, he's like, queen, queen, queen. He's like begging for a queen. And a queen comes on the turn. He's like, yes. So I said, okay, it's my turn. Diamond, diamond, diamond. And a 7 of diamonds hit. And I more than tripled up. And I had like 26,000 at like 50 and 100. I more than doubled because your starting stack is like, I think it was 12. So I had more than double my starting stack now. And then I basically rode that. I said, after that, I went to that table and abused that one guy in between me and Lee, and I had like 70,000-80,000 for most of the day, and just rode that to the end. But when I got moved to my final table, a guy on my right had 500,000 chips, and I had like 70, and then like everybody at that table had like 100 or more, and it was just okay. I got to pick a hand here because it was 6,000-12,000. With like a 1,000 ante when I got knocked out, and I had like 70,000. So I was surprised that Lee went that far when he from the point that he had 30,000, because those were pretty big blinds to have to deal with, and to get to 10th place, that's really admirable. He played really well.
He is a professional.
And so the final thing I wanted to say was the lady on my left, when I first joined that table, when she said that guy was winning, hitting everything, two hands out of like five, out of a span of five hands, Lee raised. It gets to her, and she calls. And then the flop comes, and she bets, or he bets, and she calls. And she calls him all the way down, and she wins the first one. And then the second hand, he raises, and she calls, and then she wins the hand again. And when she's raking the pot in, she turns to me, and she says, "Is he letting me win?" I said, "No, I'm pretty sure Lee is not letting you win. I think he wants to win just as badly as you do, especially since he does this for a living." And she goes, "What?" She goes, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, he's a professional." She goes, "That guy over there, that bald guy, is a professional?" I said, "I thought you were the the celebrity at this table. I said, believe me, I am not the celebrity at this table. I said, Lee's a professional player. I said, he writes for our, you ever read our magazine? And she's like, I don't really read magazines. And oh, no, I do know Annie Up. I do know it. And I was like, oh, phew. You know, I said, yeah, well, he's in there. You should pick it up and read his stuff. It's really good. It's really, you know, it's really written really well, really plain English and not intimidating at all. And started talking with everything. But it was really funny. Is Lee letting me win? So it was a real good tournament. And then, and one other thing, too, is we mostly played on, like, I play at that stud table again. I did last year, and it's so tight. And then they moved us to a normal table, but the dealers had to shuffle. And then the final table I was at, they had an automatic shuffler. And you're not going to believe this. Twice, Scott, the deck came out with boxed aces.
Wow.
So
really?
You know what that means, right? Box. So they're face up. Right. Twice. I can't believe it. Both times I had two aces faced up. So that was the most bizarre thing. And it was fairly quickly too, so it was like maybe within a span of 10 hands the guy came out and said, oh, there's an ace, and he fanned out the deck and there was another ace, and then like 10 hands later it did it again, and both times it was the same color aces, like the ones it was red aces, and the other time it was both black aces. That was the weirdest thing ever.
Wow.
It was like the shuffler knew where the cards were or something. It was really bizarre. But it was a good time. I cashed and I felt really good about it. So, you know, I think that the Annie Up poker cast now is holding down its own. I think we can change the intro now and say we both know how to play poker because we're cashing in tournaments.
And technically, there are only 52 people in my tournament, so your toaster is probably worth more than my first place prize. So.
I'll take $25 for a toaster every day on twice on Sunday.
All right, well, while you're out there having a good time and helping out some needy charities, there's a little, it's like to call it a Twitter feud going on. And, you know, I kind of wanted to bring up on the show because our Annie Up ambassador and Chad Holloway, who's actually his real job is, you know, a senior writer for Poker News. He wrote what I thought was a really good column about this week. And since it's timely, I wanted to get on the show and see what you thought about it. But to summarize, Alan Kessler, you know, world famous for being a complainer.
Yep.
At tournaments about structures or anything else. You know, huge Twitter following, and he, Twitter is his weapon of choice on getting his complaints out, right?
Right.
So he made a complaint at the World Poker Tour event up in Montreal, called out Matt Savage on it, and Matt Savage essentially said something to the effect of, you know, the day I take tournament advice from Alan Kessler is the day I die, or something like that, and then blocked Alan from his Twitter feed.
Right.
And that just enraged Alan Kessler. And it became this big back and forth, and it got a lot of life. And so Chad wrote this great column, and you can read about it on Poker News at pokernews.com. But he essentially wanted to say, hey, what is the best way of airing complaints about tournaments these days? I mean, we certainly can't avoid the fact that social media is taking over and Twitter is very popular. But is that the best way to air the complaints?
Yeah, I don't think so. Here's the deal: is I don't know if complaints. I feel like complaints in a social setting like that are just, it's just not productive. I realize that you might be, you know, getting on your soapbox and you might be calling a lot of people to your attention, but really, you know, I think if you're complaining about that one particular tournament, then you should go to that particular staff. You know, maybe it's an oversight. Maybe, and again, I don't know the particulars of the complaint or whatever exactly, but really, I always cringe when I read Twitter, and it's not just for things like this. I feel like Twitter for poker players was invented for just another vehicle to describe bad beats.
Yeah.
And it just drives me crazy. I love Twitter because you can reach a lot of people that you normally couldn't reach, because if they like it, they'll tell all their friends and so on and so on. Kind of like that hair product in the 70s. I just, when things like this, I'm not necessarily sure that it's productive or if you'll get anything done. A lot of people might resent it. I don't know. I mean, I like the idea that you can tell people your thoughts on things, but if it's not done in a constructive, you know, classy way, it's just going to come off as griping and carping, and I don't know if that necessarily does anything.
Yeah, you know, you know, we talked about Twitter on last week's show too, because we had some of that at the Annie Up Poker Tour, I think, too. And I think it's just another example. And I think Chad had a very good solution to this. Is if the tweet is constructive, it's different than a whine. And I think that's where players or people in general fall down on this kind of stuff. And it's the same on forums. You know, I've been pretty vocal about the fact that I don't like people going on forums under pseudonyms and just spouting off stuff that they wouldn't tell you in person. So I guess that's the guiding thing for me, is that if you wouldn't say this to the person, if he was standing right in front of you, then you should be going to Twitter.
Yeah.
I don't know if that really changes things here. I'm pretty sure that Alan would have said the same thing straight to Matt Savage's face. Probably did, too. But definitely, I think a little more civility might get a little farther in dealing with these. And, you know, I think that kind of the problem with the Twitter, too, that I don't really... That really kind of gets in my craw is that, you know, you're publicizing something to all your followers and potentially a lot more followers if it gets retweeted, and you only have 140 characters, and that was part of the thing, is that it's tough to have a good substantial conversation on Twitter.
Yeah.
You know, you've got these quick little bursts back and forth, and it gets really confusing if you're trying to follow it, if you're someone else. It's just not the medium for a serious conversation. And I think that's what Matt Savage was saying, is, you know, hey, this is something maybe you email me or something like that where we can give you a good response. And when you're tagging, you know, World Poker Tour or Andy Poker Tour or anything else like that on there, you know, we're in a quick society here. People just read that and they have a negative connotation, whether it's appropriate or not for them to. And it certainly does get attention, so that's why it works, but it's probably not the overall the best way to get stuff done.
I you know what, too, is, and I agree with you, because people try to turn Twitter into Facebook, or they try to turn it into email, and that's not what it's meant for. When they came out with Twitter, I mean, it's basically built right into the name there. It's kind of like this brief sort of thing that, you know, you're just trying to update people on your situation or something, a witty witticism, something thought quickly happened to you or whatever. And instead, people are doing pages and pages and pages of posts, you know, and it's like, look, that's not what this is for. It's an update thing. People are following you because they want to know what's going on in your life for that moment or what's interesting you at that second, you know, or whatever. And it's not Facebook where you can type as long as you want and send it to who you want to send it to. You know what I mean? It's not the same vehicle, and people are just using it as that vehicle, and that's where you get into trouble because you only have that 140 characters. You know, and if somebody's not following you religiously all day long, they might miss your post or two. Yeah. You know, and then have to go on because a lot of apps will only show, you know, within the last few whatever hours of what, you know, not, it won't show you every single post that person did unless you go to their actual you know, feed and then click on what all of their tweets are. And then even then you get lost sometimes because then you have to follow what the other people were tweeting in the conversation. And it's not Facebook, and people are treating it like Facebook because that's what they were used to first, but they see this new thing, it's bright, shiny object. And, you know, I agree. I think that any kind of grievances like that shouldn't be aired like that. They should be brought to the person's attention in a constructive, private way, you know. And if it's a tournament thing, then go to the tournament staff. You know, why are you letting everybody know that you're unhappy with this? Let them know, and maybe they'll come with a solution and tell you, you know, rather than making everybody think, oh, this place doesn't know what they're doing, when actually you might have been wrong, and now that's all they saw was your side of it. I don't know. I just, it's interesting dynamic, and I'm not sure that grievances should be made on that.
All right, well, we definitely, you can air your grievances on our Antioch hotline, and people often do, including this week. Mr. No Swag called in. Actually, he calls in hourly these days, but we don't have time to get all of them on the show, but today he had one that I thought was worthy of discussing. And remind everyone to call our hotline at 813-448-1120, just like Mr. No Swag did. And here's what he had to say this week.
I just wanted to give you a buzz. I just had the opportunity to listen to the most recent O'Malley move and wanted to offer a small protest in that I am a big hater of hands that don't really come to a conclusion. Yes, I understand we have to learn lessons from everything, but the fact that we don't get to know what the other person has, whether or not you made the right move, so on and so forth, I think kind of defeats the whole purpose.
Here's what I have to say about that. Tough noogies.
Tough noogies.
This is reality. Poker, you don't always get to know what the other person has, and that's one of the things that frustrates you as a poker player, and that's what happens sometimes. You know, just because there's no resolution doesn't mean you couldn't learn from it. That's how I feel.
Yeah, yeah. And he mentioned that, but I think I understand, because we've had this question before, or this comment before, and I understand the frustration is that. And the flip side of this is, yeah, in poker, there'll be times that you don't know anything. When you're doing a show where you can pick and choose what you include on the show, then you can pick stuff that has a resolution. So I get that point of view. But I'm going to tend to side in the anti-Mr. No Swag camp this time and saying that as frustrating as it is, I think it reminds us how frustrating this game is, and there's still value talking about it, which he admits. And perhaps there's probably more value in it than I think people think. That you know, if you go into the O'Malley's minute or the hand of the week, and with the expectation that there's going to be a resolution, that's where you start to get where it gives you the red ass when it doesn't happen. But if you just go into it saying, you know what, I don't know what's going to happen here. I'm going to treat it just like a poker hand where I don't know what's going to happen. You know, maybe you don't get as angry about that, and maybe you'll learn a little bit more than you were when you were just focused on, I can't wait to hear what this guy has.
Plus, it's still, you're looking at a different interpretation of the hand, how to play it differently. You know, just because you don't know the result doesn't mean that you didn't learn something from, like you said, or that, you know, you might have been screaming at the radio saying, oh my God, you know, why didn't you do this or why didn't you do that, and makes you think differently about it. And the other thing, too, is misery loves company. You know, O'Malley, I'm sure he was miserable that he didn't learn how somebody finished a hand, and now you're miserable too. So he's like, hey, I don't want to be the only one that doesn't know how this ends. I want everyone else to feel my frustration. And that's beauty. That's why people tell bad beat stories. You know, they want you to feel their pain. So
comforting.
Exactly.
All right, well, we've always joked about how Mr. No Swag already has swag, but turns out he calls himself that because he's never won any swag.
He didn't want any, though, right? He even said he didn't want it.
He said that, but now, you know, winds are changing. That's fine. So we're going to take care of that this week. We're going to send you a classic tournament dealer button from tournamentbutton.com, which offers a variety of home dealer buttons with timers built into them. You can even customize them with your own photo or logo. Be sure to ask about the Anti-Up logo version and use code Anti-Up for free shipping. And Mr. No Swag, we're going to have to know a real name here.
Yeah.
And address.
We're going to call him Mr. One-Time Swag.
One-Time Swag.
Or Mr. Swag.
Very good. So just in case you don't have the number, Mr. No Swag, it's 813-448-1120. Give us a ring and we will get that prize out to you.
All right, our mailbag this week comes from Adam Bergen. He says, I am a nursing student working in a hospital. He has weird hours, obviously. And also, he has a wife and a kid. I don't have much time for poker. I have gone from a once-a-week player to a once-every-couple-of-months player. My plan is, once I finish school and I'm working, is to go back to playing once a week, maybe even more. What is the best way to keep my skills up over the next couple of years and with only playing every couple of months?
Well, this is an oldie but goodie. We've probably gone over this once a year, I think, probably, since we've done the show, but I'm going to encourage him to use books and software and other tools out there. Find a good poker podcast that comes out every Thursday afternoon, even though it says it's Friday. you know, a monthly poker magazine that's really awesome. Anything like that that kind of keeps you in the game even without playing. I do think there's this misconception, and I talk about this when I do the Poker 101 on the cruises when you're not there. Certainly, you'll learn a lot more by playing poker. Learn a lot more about poker by playing poker.
Right.
But if you can't, there's still a lot of stuff you can do to learn. And, you know, when I've done the Poker 101, I'm like, let's go home and deal out 10 hands and practice a little bit. It's not the same, but it's something at least. And the fact is that you can't actually play, or else you would be playing, or you wouldn't be writing a saying you couldn't play, right?
Right.
So you got to take that out of the equation and just do things that keep you interested in the game.
Well, here's the thing. If he's got about an hour or so, because obviously if he's going to find time to read, you know what I mean, then he's going to find time to do something else. So there are other things you could do. You could watch poker on TV just to keep it fresh, keep you hungry. You could play online for an hour. Think about how many hands you could play online for an hour. And I mean, you could play for free money. You don't have to play for real money on the questionable sites. So, you know, you could play for real money on the subscription sites. You know, I mean, if you have an hour to kill, you can play 70 hands of poker. You know what I mean? That's not too much. You know what I mean? I mean as far as time-wise, that's not that much that you're asking. So if you're asking for, like, should I read a book? Okay, well, how long do you think you're going to read a book for? An hour? Well, you could play 70 hands of poker for an hour. So I think that it depends on how much time you have, realizing that you're not going to go play an 8-hour session down at your local brick-and-mortar place. But, you know, you get up and sit at your computer for an hour, that's a lot of hands. Think about that for a minute. If you went to a brick-and-mortar room and played poker, the average is about 30 to 33 hands an hour. That's literally 2.5 hours of brick-and-mortar play. So if you could squeeze out an hour and a half or 2 hours of online play, that's like a full session at your brick-and-mortar place. So I don't know if you necessarily have to give up poker that much if you could find an hour or two here and there, you know, especially if you're going to be willing to read or watch TV, watch poker on TV or something to that effect. So I would give that a shot.
Yeah, yeah. And even, you know, again, we're going to talk about this later with our guest today, but, you know, smartphones are just amazing these days.
Yeah.
You've got 100 different apps on them and stuff. And, you know, I play this Words with Friends and Scramble with Friends, but I'm not one of these people that wakes up in the morning and catches up on my games. I play them when I'm waiting in line at the post office or somewhere else like that. And there are a gajillion good poker apps out there that you could steal 30 seconds, 2 minutes, 5 minutes, you know, when you're otherwise detained somewhere, and next thing you know, that hour that you have turns into 2 or 3 hours just because you're focusing that wasted time on poker. So,
right, exactly.
You know, find some. Every player's different, and, you know, some apps are going to be better for other players than others, but I would take some time in that, you know, that app store and mess around with a couple that fit your bill.
Well, speaking of apps, what a segue.
Yes, it's just amazing how these prizes just happen to match up perfectly with
our advice.
Exactly. We're going to send you a download of the Chinese 13-card poker app for Apple products from Snapsoft. You don't have to be a winner to enjoy this great app. You can download it yourself by visiting the iTunes store. And remember, everybody else, email your questions to podcast@antiupmagazine.com. And you two are going to get a fantastic prize.
Did you have any idea last week, when we were talking about this last longer bet, that we would get people calling and emailing about it? I mean, it's absolutely hilarious to me. Doc Frank, who's, you know, our one of our good friends and home gamer and frequent cruiser, and, you know, he emailed us a funny sort of way of looking at the last longer, you know, quoting Einstein and all this other stuff. And then we got a call from Thietza, too, our good friend Thietza, who's also gone on a couple of cruises. Well, let's listen to her clip first.
I'm calling about the last longer bet conversation you just had on the last podcast. If there is a side pot, they're both in the same hand, but there's a side pot, the person with the most chips is going to go out first if he gets busted. And then the main pot goes to the smaller, gets busted second, right?
Yeah, you know what? When she called in, I was going to say, you know what? We're just going to skip this. I mean, we don't put everything that people call in on the show, right?
Right.
And then Dr. Frank wrote and said the exact same thing about the side pot. And then, of course, we had a couple other emails and things, too. And you're right. I mean, it's amazing to me what out of 2.5 bloated hours of this poker cast every week, the 30 seconds or so that just gets people in a tizzy. And I certainly didn't think this was going to be it. But, you know, since we got that feedback, that's why we put it on here. And, you know, here's what I'm going to say about the side pot. Let's just admit that it's fairly ridiculous that we're talking about this thing a second time, right?
All right.
This is not an official poker discussion at all. This is a friendly bet between two idiots, right? And so however you want to resolve it, between the two idiots is the way it needs to be resolved, case being said.
But, you know, if we're talking about the side pot, yes, technically, in terms of the time on the clock on the wall, if you could find a clock on the wall in a casino, the guy who's in the side pot who has the most chips will be walking away from the table knowing that he's eliminated before the guy with a smaller amount of chips that's in the main pot, right?
Right.
But the guy that had chips in the side pot also has chips in the main pot, right? So, technically, in the casino's eyes, he's not really eliminated until that main pot is pushed to the player, which happens at the exact same time that the smaller stacks chips that are in the main pot are being pushed to that winner as well, too. So, again, it's even, Steven. Kiss your sister or your brother, whichever you would rather do.
Because, and here's another thing to think about. Let's say the person in the main pot who's in the bet with you now turns over ace of spades, ace of spades. Now you got a foul deck and the hand didn't count. So now, just because you thought you got eliminated a minute ago in the side pot, now all of a sudden, ho, this wasn't a legitimate deck. Everyone gets their money back, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, that's true. And the other thing, too, is, first of all, we didn't know if these guys were at the same table or not.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, that was one thing. So, yes, you can bring up the whole side pot idea, but it could have just very well been they were right next to each other's table. They were both standing up to be eliminated on the same hand at the same time, and then hand A got, you know, he got eliminated on, and hand B he got eliminated on, but it was the same hand at the same time. And so if you want to get all metaphysical and all whatever and technical and say, okay, well, the minute that the dealer turns over the final card is not precisely the exact, that's all just bull. But if you want to take it to that extreme, you could all say, okay, well, we weren't counting the amount of hands that were dealt to us. I had faster dealers than you did, so I'm going to say that I had more hands than you did, so I lasted longer than you because we're counting it by, you know what I mean? So there's all these different ways you could try to make this last longer bet. The best thing is to just say, you know what, let's not have a last longer bet. You know what I mean? I mean, it's just
really,
crazy.
What's wrong with do-over? Do-over works so well.
I know. When you were a kid, that's why you had it. That's right.
Yeah. Hey, I was safe. No, you were out. Okay, do-over.
Do-over.
Solve.
Start over.
Go back up and hit the ball again. Kick the ball again. You know, hey, do-over. Let's just play another tournament. It can't happen that way twice in a row, right? But one more thing before I pass on that actually is a real-life situation that I think is kind of interesting because of what we're talking about here is, you know, part of what we were talking about at the NEA Poker Tour event last week was, you know, they were playing hand for hand at each pay step, and that's what some of the players were curious about, and Matt Savage, you know, talked to the poker manager, said, no, you know, you don't do that. In fact, he's like, back at the World Series, you know, even, you know, there are people get knocked out all the time. And we don't know who got knocked out first or not. So, so really, I mean, probably the true angle in this is whoever's slowest walking ends up being the highest finisher, probably. When you get to the cage, you're like, okay, you went out at the same time? Okay, well, you're 396. The really quick kid back there is 402 because he got here first to get his money. So, it's all inexact. So,
yeah.
You know, figure it out on your own.
Absolutely.
Right? All right, well, speaking of the NEA Poker Tour, we crowned our first champion this week. Juan Kung of Sacramento, California, is our first NEA Poker Tour champion, taking down the main event of the NEA NorCal Classic at Thunder Valley Casino Resort. He's going to be on the cover of our January edition of NEA Magazine. And don't forget that Red Rock Casino Resort and Spa in Las Vegas will host the next NEA Poker Tour event. That's going to be on January 25th with satellites beginning January 21st. I'll be out there, so come out, say hi, take a shot at making the cover of NEA Magazine. And if you're going to stay a place, you can do a lot worse than Red Rock Resort. It's a triple, four diamond AAA room out there, and they have special NEA room rates of $89. And you can take advantage of those rates by clicking the link on our NEA Poker Tour website, and that is anteuppokertour.com, and all the details and all of our other events will be there as well.
Don't forget, Jonathan Little's going to be our pro on the February 4th cruise out of Port Canaveral, and we're past our rate guarantee deadline now, so you got to book as soon as possible so we can try to get you on and get you a good rate. Also sailing out of Miami, New York City, and Tampa next year. Get all the details, including how you can win your way on board at Dover Downs, Derby Lane, Tampa Bay Downs, Daytona Beach Kennel Club, and Seneca Salamanca at anteuppcruises.com. Okay, Scott. What happened on the news desk this week?
Ray First, one of the three, wow. Had a little,
full tilt.
A little problem there, and they know it's there. All right, it's right over. Ray First, one of the three Full Tilt executives facing a civil complaint over the demise of Full Tilt Poker, has settled his case with the U.S. Department of Justice. First, who admitted no wrongdoing, will forfeit an undisclosed amount of money seized just after Black Friday, will pay a $150,000 fine, and may never, ever, ever, ever again work for another online poker company. The civil complaints against Howard Letter and Chris Ferguson remain unresolved.
It's always weird that it's undisclosed.
Well, I think kind of the confusion is that he had money in a couple different bank accounts that were his company's bank accounts. It's really, you know, this whole thing is obviously very confusing.
Yeah.
And there was some disagreement over how much of that money was in there. But safe to say, I'm sure it's more money than you and I will ever see in our lives.
The American Gaming Association has begun a new lobbying effort to get a federal bill regulating online poker passed before the end of the year. The AGA warns Congress that inaction will result in a patchwork of various state regulations that will put players at risk and be a burden to law enforcement agencies.
Yeah, we're seeing this already. New Jersey is renewing their efforts to get their state going, too. So, hope it works. Clock is running here.
Yeah.
Got exactly about a month here left, so hopefully something happens. And finally, in sad news this week, renowned poker author, columnist, radio host, and player Lou Krieger passed away on Monday after a short battle with cancer.
Yeah, we had a chance to chat with him just a few months ago, and he's a great guy. He knew everything there was to know about poker, and it's really sad. We had a chance to actually have him work with us, but sadly he was diagnosed with the cancer right around that time, and we never had a chance to actually get together with him. So the poker world's going to miss that guy.
Yeah, absolutely. It's great to see the kind of the outpouring. A lot of love on Facebook for him.
And Twitter.
You know, and tonight on Hold'em Radio, if you're actually listening on Thursday, they're doing a tribute show to him during the time his show normally airs. Fifth Street Radio is doing stuff all week too. So certainly a lot of people out there really respect what he did, and absolutely feel terrible that we lost him so soon.
Okay, so we get a brand new O'Malley's Move this week. Let's see how it goes.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we are seated at a $1, $2, no limit hold'em cash game. The action has been fairly steady all night. There aren't any maniacs at our table, and while there are some new players to the game, everyone plays fairly straightforward poker. But they love to trap, and the check raise has been overused like a bad cliche. The blind's post, and it's folded all the way around to us on the button with the jack of clubs, eight of clubs, and $275 behind. We're going to make a steal attempt here. Usually this is only sound poker in a tournament. In cash games, you'd want to play straight up. Just muck this and move on to the next hand. However, with this table's dynamic, it's pretty easy to tell what our opponents are doing. There's a good chance we can steal the blinds here, and if not, we have a good chance of knowing where we are after the flop. We might even hit something, but that's plan C. We make it $10 to go, the standard raise. The small blind folds, but the big blind calls. He's got us covered. The pot is $20, and the flop comes the ace of clubs, king of diamonds, queen of clubs. Very interesting. We flopped the second nut flush draw and an inside Broadway draw. Our opponent checks to us, and we're going to keep up our aggression. With $20 in the pot, we make a $12 bet, and he calls. The turn is the king of clubs, another interesting card. It gives us the nut flush, but it pairs the board. However, we've picked up an inside royal flush draw. And again, our opponent checks to us. What on earth is he doing? Our spidey sense is tingling. so we check behind. Even though there weren't many cards we could have seen on the turn to improve our hand this much. The pot is about $40, and the river is the 10 of hearts. Once again, our opponent checks. Okay, we've got him this time. We count out a value bet of about half the pot, $20. But this time, he raises us to $100. Was he slow playing a monster? Or is it just a jack? More importantly, what do we do?
All right, Chris, we all know there are only three things certain in life: death, taxes, and questions about taxes. And that's why we wanted to welcome Ann Margaret Johnson to the show today. Ann Margaret is a certified public accountant from Georgia who has been playing poker for 15 years now and specializes in poker accounting issues. She writes a regular column on tax issues for Anti-Up Magazine and runs the PokerDeductions.com website. Ann Margaret, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. It's going to be a fun time to enjoy Christmas and then jump right into tax season.
Always your favorite time of the year, I imagine.
Always. I just love it.
All right. Well, we have a couple weeks left in 2012. So what kind of things can and should poker players be doing before the end of the year in terms of tax preparation for their playing?
Well, as we all know, we don't know much about what's going to happen with this fiscal cliff stuff. So we just need to operate basically the way we have been. A lot of my regular, normal, I should say, clients with businesses, I'm telling them to not necessarily accelerate their expenses like we normally tell people to do, because we know tax rates are going up next year. No matter what, we do know that. So the one thing I would tell my poker clients as well is, don't make a huge effort to accelerate expenses, meaning don't go out to Bellagio or whatever and play a tournament unless you're planning on doing it anyway. So don't try to do things to get expenses on the books by the end of the year. You're going to have plenty of time next year to try to have expenses. Biggest thing, again, is now's a great time with the holidays, and if you're sitting at home with nothing to do and can't play online at home, start getting together your records and try to get together what you won and what you lost, and find all those little receipts if you're a professional player of when you went to Vegas and when you flew out to Aussie Millions and PCA and all that. So now's the time to start getting things together so your accountant, no matter who he or she is, will not hate you forever and up your bill when you give them a big stack of stuff in a shoebox. So, or the typical, I don't know. So
even worse.
Now's a good time to start getting your little financial house in order and get ready and try to get your tax return done timely.
Well, you know, you talk about the records and things like that, and on January 1st, of course, we'll all be making our New Year's resolutions saying, you know, we're going to keep better records this year of our wins and losses. So can you walk us through about maybe how you recommend to your clients how they should do this, especially since it's largely a cash business?
Yeah, and I'll share with you, I had a client that came to me that did his own tax return, and he was being audited, and he plays totally cash games. He'll do some tournaments, but he mostly played up in Atlantic City, and the IRS is one of the first audits that I've seen, and it was wonderful, and the reason it was wonderful is because this guy wrote down on he had a piece of paper, and he kind of had it all labeled out of date, time, table, you know, sit down, stand up amount, and he kept records for that. And because he did such a great job in doing that, the IRS didn't give him any flack at all. So basically, they took his handwritten pieces of paper and didn't say a word about it. So it's important that you have a really good log. It's important that you keep up with what you did, because you can write down all day, oh, you know, I won $500,000 and I lost $550,000. That's great, but then they're going to want to say, okay, if you get audited, they're going to want to say, okay, how did that happen? And another way to do it, if you didn't do like my client did and keep those records, because that takes a pretty anal person and not always poker players are that way, the best thing to do is try to do a log or recreate a log. So what you want to do, and I put it on my website, it's under, I think it's under tax advice, there's an Excel link, and you can do an Excel spreadsheet that basically says that I said before, which is, what's the date, about what time, where were you playing, so what casino, and I was playing at a 10-20, no limit, and I sat down with 500 and I walked away with 1200. And you just got to recreate it, and you know you got to do the best you can. And the IRS basically is required to accept any reasonable record of your activity. So you got to do something. You can't just give, you know, you can give me a number all day, but if you get audited, you've got to have some way to substantiate how you came up with that number.
So if you were a tournament player only, could something like Hendon Mob aid you in your explanation of things?
It can, but it can also hurt you. Your best bet, if you're a tournament player especially, you're going to need receipts.
Okay.
You really need to keep those receipts. And you can't always rely on the fact that you gave the casino your player's card and they're going to have a record of it.
Right.
It's not true. You've got to keep those receipts.
Okay.
And you don't even have to give your accountant, you don't have to give me the receipts, just you can total them up. Or I tell a lot of my guys, you know, keep your receipts. If you want, send them to me. I'll scan them in your file, and I've got them. And then you don't have to worry about it. Especially, W2Gs. When you win a tournament and the casino gives you that form, I can't tell you how many of my guys forget or lose it, or, oh, I didn't remember I won, you know, $200,000 at that tournament.
And happens all the time.
So I try to research. One favor I do my clients is I know what they're like. So I try to go to cardplayer.com or to you know, several sources, poker pages, and I try to look up and see, okay, what's out there on the internet about my client that they haven't told me? Oh, it happens to be that they won that $200,000 tournament they totally forgot to tell me about. And if I don't list, and if any accountant does not list those tournaments separately, you can't just put them on a form. You've got to list out those W-2s, each one of them separately, because the IRS matches those up. So that's what will get you in trouble. I can't tell you how many, at least 25 of my clients that didn't tell me about W-2Gs that the IRS knew about that I didn't see online, even though I tried to look. And next thing you know, they're saying, oh, you owe us, you know, $10,000 in back taxes because you didn't tell us about the W-2G. Well, yeah, it was in their number, but because they didn't list it out separate, it triggered a slight audit, so to speak, of their tax return. Now, do I get them out of it? Absolutely, because all I have to do is say, oops, my client forgot. They did put it on their tax return. It's in that huge number. They just forgot to list out separately the fact that they got this form. So that's really, really important. And especially, too, you know, I tell my guys, hey, as soon as you get it, send it to me, mail it to me, email it, I don't care. Take a picture with your phone. Just let me have that document, because I not only do I have to say the Rio on June 5th for X amount of dollars, but I've got to have the casino's federal ID number, and I don't have it. Some of them, I have most of them in my file that I can always do, but some of them I don't have. Some of the real funky ones, like in Oklahoma or whatever, I don't necessarily have that. So that's a biggie with tournament players.
Especially with technology today, I mean, you know, your phone can pretty much be an entire computer by itself. The instant you get something like that, you can literally have it in your hands in seconds.
Oh, I know. I know. It's funny because I told one of my players, you know, he was like, I said, look, just get me that form. I don't know how to get you that form. I can't, you know, I don't want to mail, you know, how that goes.
Yeah.
I don't want to mail it to you. I don't have time to get to the post office. I don't even have a stamp, you know. And I said, take a picture with your phone. They're like, oh, okay. I didn't think about that.
Well, I mean, everyone
and their mother has a phone, you know, with a camera on it. So,
well, speaking of phones, I'm curious whether you or any of your clients are aware of any apps that might help keeping a log of your cash gameplay, your tournament play. It seems like everybody is as Chris said. I mean, it's like you're a third arm for people now, and that seems like to me an easier way of keeping track than remembering when you get back home and opening your Excel spreadsheet.
I know, and you know what, I can't. I think there is an app. I just can't think of what it is because I think I downloaded it where you keep – I did a while back, but I don't think I have it anymore. But there is an app out there, and I do believe it's free, where you can put your session wins in. Hmm. I'm sorry. I can't remember the name of it, but I know there is an app out there.
So there is. I know there definitely is an app. I'm actually looking it up while we're talking because I remember, I think, yeah, matter of fact, I think even Grindr had something to that effect, but there is one called Poker Income Ultimate. It's free. And then Poker Bankroll is free.
Yeah, I think that's the one I have.
And then there's a pro bankroll poker income one that's like $10. And there's a poker journal light. There's a few, quite a few of them, poker tracker light. So there are quite a few that will do it for you. We're not plugging them because they're not, you know, clients of ours or anything like that. But yeah, there are some things you could probably do that way as well.
But yeah, anything you can do.
Yeah, but when folks are looking at those different apps, obviously there's some information, as you already mentioned, that's pretty key that might not be part of those, right? So, I mean, obviously it's the time and the length of the session, right, that's important to log as well. It's just the win-loss, correct?
Yeah. I mean, and as much, you know, you don't have to do all this detail, but the more you have, the more legitimate it looks when they're auditing, because you know this. I mean, it goes without saying. The IRS is looks at a poker player as a cheat, you know? I mean, that's our first thing. It's a cash business, so, oh, you know, we don't trust you, we don't believe you. And so you really need to convince them that, hey, I keep good records. I'm a good person, and I keep good records, and I'm a good taxpayer, and I'm a good poker pro, and I'm treating this like a business. That's the biggest thing you need to do.
Excellent. Well, you know, we asked our listeners to send us some questions. And here's a basic yet popular one from Ken Allard. He's actually our Moneymaker winner. He actually had to have lunch, or actually didn't get to have lunch with him, but sat with Moneymaker a little while ago and got some advice from him. So he wants to know, can you write off losses to match your winnings? And if so, how do you do this?
Now, is he a professional? Are we talking about professional, a hobby, or both?
In his case, I think it was a hobby since he was a chef. But maybe you could just tell us both in case we have aspiring players, maybe.
Okay, the answer to that is yes, you can. If whether you're a hobby or a pro, if you win $100,000 and you lose $100,000, the way you report on your tax return is different, but the basics are the same. Yes, if I won it and I lost it all, then you just write it off down to zero.
Okay.
But you can't net that. So let's say that I do this for fun and I win $50,000, and then I go below $50,000. I can't say I zero. I don't really need to put it on my tax return. Yeah, you do. Unfortunately, you need to put the 50 on and then show the 50 loss. So okay. It's important you do that.
Okay.
And just to clarify to our listeners too, as the ones that don't know, you can't deduct losses without having wins to compensate them. Correct. So I mean, if I lose $2,000 this year and I have no wins to do that, I'm not going to get a tax deduction for that loss, correct?
Nope, you cannot. This is the only business on the planet where you cannot have a loss. You can you can net them, but and that's the really crappy part, because if you've got you got a player that wins $12 million one year and pays tax on it and does everything, and then the next year he loses $12 million, that he doesn't get a credit for that at all.
Hmm.
It really stinks, and I wish that some legislature, you know, could change this, because it's not fair. I mean, all businesses have losses, and you get really screwed if you're a poker player, because there's nothing you can do about it if it's not all within the same year.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's say, as a hobby, somebody goes out and plays in a charity tournament and wins it, and wins, like, $2,000. And then that's the only tournament they ever play, because they always play cash games, but they were doing it as a charity. So now, can you now tell the IRS that $2,000 I lost in cash games, and as long as you're documenting it, and then it sets it off?
If you document it, yeah, you're fine.
Okay, so even if it's a hobby to you?
Yes.
Okay.
The only thing you cannot do if it's a hobby is deduct expenses.
Right, okay.
So if I do this for fun. So I fly to the World Series every single year, and I can only deduct what I win and what I lose. I cannot deduct as a poker expense my travel.
Okay.
Because I'm just doing it for fun. So all I can do is my wins and my losses when you're a hobby.
Excellent.
Okay, a related one here from Detour GLR. Do I have to include comps as income? And if so, what do I use as the value? Is the casino required to give me a value? And as a follow-up, I know that I can deduct gambling losses to the extent of gambling income. Are comps counted as gambling income for this purpose?
I hate this question. Because it's one of those things that you ask five accountants this question, you're going to get five answers.
Hmm.
Because I've researched and I read it, and there's nothing definitive. It's similar to like frequent flyer miles. You know, I earn these miles. I go take a trip. I go to Europe first class, there's a $12,000 cost if I bought the ticket. Mm-hmm. So do I claim $12,000 in income? No, because I kind of earn those miles, you know, spent money. In my opinion, this is totally my opinion, the comps, if they are small, like a free hotel room, a free meal, all those things, those are incidental. And how do you put a value on a free hotel room? People can get them for $39 a night if they're a poker player. So how do you do that? It's really tough. I've seen several ways that people justify. I've seen them say, well, it's income, you should do it. You can offset your gambling losses. Okay, fine, if you want to go that route. That's probably, that you could do that. I've also had people, or I've read things where it says, it's a gift. People can gift you up to, $13,000 a year, so, we just count, the casino can gift it to you. That's stretching it as well. My opinion is these are incidental things. If someone comps you something, huge, maybe, but there's really no record of this. There's nothing out there where it's being given to you on a piece of paper saying, hey, I just comped you $2 worth of water, so you need to put that in your tax return. I think that's kind of crazy. In the scheme of things, you're not talking about a lot of money. The casino, absorbs this. You basically, by being there and playing and spending your money with them, kind of earn this, like those frequent flyers or like those little bonus things you get. I don't even broach the subject with my clients at all. I just don't. I mean, they're usually so incidental, it's not going to make a difference.
Excellent. It's because it's kind of like you're sitting there playing slots and they come by with scotch for you. It's like, do I have to tell the IRS that I got a free scotch? I mean, it's just kind of weird.
I don't even want to meet the person that's going to do that.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, well, Doug Walters, one of our listeners, has a question about charity events. He says, I played in a charity poker tournament. I took second place and donated all of my winnings back to the girls' basketball team. What kind of documentation do I need to write it off? From the tournament director, the high school basketball team?
You need something. Okay, whoever you donate that money back to, let's say you hand them cash, which usually is what happens. You need, and you can't feel like a heel because it's just the way life is, you need to say, hey, I need a receipt from the organization saying I donated X amount of dollars. You got to make sure that that organization is a true 501c3 or a true charitable organization recognized by the IRS. If you give it to someone whose daughter was in a car accident and everybody's collecting money for the medical bills, nope, you can't do it. You're just a nice person. But if you turn around, like for example, Annie Duke did the Annie Up for Africa all those times. If you turn around and hand her, $10,000 of your $100,000 winning, you need to say, I need a receipt for that to show that I made a charitable donation for it. If you don't, you're going to pay tax on it.
All right.
That's the only way to avoid paying tax on it. Hmm. So, I mean, it's nice if you want to be real generous about, but don't be crazy. Get a receipt. Because you're going to get a W-2G for the full amount, and you're going to have to claim it. Having that receipt from that charity is the only way to offset that.
Excellent. Well, following up on Doug's question, there are a lot of charity poker tournaments held every year around the country. To what extent are the buy-ins from them tax-deductible?
It's the same thing as if you're a hobby or a professional player. If I go to Vegas and I spend, $1,000 in buy-ins, and I win $2,000, then I just offset the two on my tax return. The problem, back what we said before, let's say that I go to Vegas and I do all these charity tournaments and I end up with $10,000 in buy-ins for charity tournaments with no wins whatsoever, I lose that. It's not a deduction. Tournament buy-ins are different. It's not like you're donating to the charity necessarily. You're giving them money, but in order to play to win money. So,
are you able to, if you're able to have some kind of documentation from the room as to how much of your buy-in went directly to the charity, count that as a charitable deduction?
That would be helpful. Yeah, okay. That would be helpful. And, again, getting it on their letterhead or one of their receipts saying that, John donated $1,000 or played a poker tournament for $1,000 and $500 of that went directly to our charity. Then you got a charitable deduction of $500.
Excellent.
Cool, very cool. Ever since the settlement of Full Tilt Poker was announced, we've been deluged with questions from listeners wondering if the money they'll eventually receive from the settlement will be taxable. Do you have a take on this?
Yeah. If I don't know if people realize this, but whether you kept money on the site or not, if you won money, you know, at the end of the year, you're supposed to look at your wins and losses, whether you kept it on the site or not. I know a lot of poker players said, no, 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 I didn't take it off. I'm not going to claim it, which is not correct. But let's say that's what happened. Let's say that you won. Because remember, what you have stuck on there isn't necessarily your wins and losses. It's just the cash, you know, it's your bankroll. Every year when you do your tax return, you're supposed to look at your wins and your losses and claim your stuff on that. So let's say that I did everything I was supposed to, and every year I looked at my wins and looked at my losses, and I did them on my tax return. Okay, now, a year from now, I get a check for $5,000 from Full Tilt. You have to ask yourself, did I already account for this on my tax return? If you didn't, if I said, no, it's stuck on there, I'm not going to claim it, then you do need to claim that. If it's true wins, if all that $5,000 they give you is wins, then yes, you need to. But remember, they may not be just wins. That may be money you put in and you lost, and you won some and you lost some. So you've got to look at the fact, what were my wins and what were my losses? Did I claim them on a tax return? If the answer is no, and all of the money you get from Full Tilt were all wins that you didn't claim, then yes, you need to claim that on the tax return for the year that you received that money.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, so in other words, if you were dumb enough to deposit money the day before Black Friday and you lost that money, but you didn't have to play with it or anything, then when you get it back, you don't have to do anything at all because all it was is a deposit.
Right. You've got to go backwards and say, okay, where... I got money they're writing me a check for, you know, $1 million. Okay, have I already claimed that, or is that, you know, the wins and losses are already on a tax return that I've already taken care of? That's what you got to ask yourself. And if something happens, you know, you could put. I would recommend people putting it on their tax return and then backing it off, saying already claimed it on 2009 or something like that. I doubt very seriously if we get this money, and I still say if. I doubt they're going to just hand over money without getting your social.
Right.
And I guess that's what has prompted most of the questions. And so I got a kind of a difficult question here for you based on that. You know, with online poker, with, let's say, home games that might be illegal, I think there's some apprehension among our listeners about reporting income from those, essentially admitting to an illegal activity in some case. Even though, obviously, the IRS wants you to report all income. So I think kind of the question I think that what our listeners are more worried about is they probably haven't been reporting wins or losses from online because they never thought there'd be any kind of paper trail. Now, all of a sudden, there is a paper trail. They're getting, you know, a check probably from the government. You know, they are going to have to give their social, and now feeling a little weird about it. I don't know where I'm going with that question, but I guess the question is, what kind of advice do we have on folks on essentially admitting to something that they shouldn't have been doing on their taxes?
Well, I mean, technically, if you omitted income, you should file an amended return and go ahead and report the income and, you know, just explain that I neglected to report X amount of dollars, was an oversight, and here's the tax and interest and penalties and blah, blah, blah. That's one way to do it. Another thing, to answer the, people are afraid, you know, to put on their tax return because it's illegal, you know, I've always said this before. Remember, that's how they got Al Capone. Not for what he was doing, but for the fact he didn't report it. If you are, and I tell my guys this, you know, they're worried, okay, all I do is play online. I really don't want to put that on my tax return. Fine. You don't put it on your tax return. You put it on as a Schedule C if you're a professional, and you call it gambling winnings. Gambling is not illegal. It's done all over the, you know, we know that in the U.S. Gambling in general is not illegal. So you go to Vegas, you gamble, you know, everybody does it. Obviously, that's not illegal, so that's what you put. You don't need, like, one of the tax preparers I got a form from, he puts on his return, my client is a young professional online poker player that does this, you know, at his house on a computer, you know, on playing on online sites out of the country. Really? No. And what happened, actually, this is a true story, that happened, I got a kid as a new client, and I said, I want to see a copy of your last year's tax return. And I looked at that, and I said, you are screwed. You are going to get audited. Your accountant just waved a flag saying, come get me. And the guy got audited. In fact, we're still dealing with the audit right now because, you know, he asked me to do it because he's like, I'm not letting this idiot do this. So you don't wave a flag and say, hey, I'm claiming money from my cocaine business where I buy and sell and make, you know, tons of money. You just say marketing or advertising. You don't necessarily have to, you know, come clean on everything. You just say gambling. You don't need to say online poker player gambling outside the U.S., you know, illegally. So just the biggest thing is claim it, because the one thing they can never get you for is not claiming your money.
Right. Well, you know, when online poker is eventually regulated, what do you think is going to happen? Are they going to just be looking for the money that the actual sites are paying taxes on, or do you think that we're going to have to supply Social Security numbers and they're going to keep an eye on every one of our players?
Yeah, I think they're gonna see transactions. The only time it's gonna be like any other thing. The only time I think they're gonna keep an eye on it is if they audit you.
Okay.
But I would say it's gonna be regulated. I don't know if you guys have been to one of these particular casinos, but there's one in Cherokee, North Carolina, and it's on the Indian reservation. You cannot play poker without a player's card. Mm-hmm. You go to the window and you fund your player's card. So I'll go up there and I'll fund it for $500. And you go and you sit down, and it's not live dealers, obviously. They have a software that you sit down with other people. And you scan your card in, and your card on the screen says, oh, you've got $500 credit. Mm-hmm. And you start using, you know, I could put $200 down. And then when I get up from the table, I go back to the cashier, and then she gives me whatever money is on the card. So let's say there's $300 on the card. Well, then I just... It's a very clear trail that I lost $200.
Right.
Or I go to the window and I got $1,000, and so she hands it to me. Obviously, it's very clear that I won $500. I think everything's going to start going to that. I think even Vegas, it'll be a while, but I think everyone will start going to that because the IRS knows this is the one cash area that they don't have any control over.
Yeah.
But the way Cherokee does this, there's control. You can't play without that card. You can't do anything until you go to that window and you give them a photo ID.
Well, they have dealers now, too, so I wonder if they've changed that system, right? That's the one that had dealers now?
They're not yet.
They're about
I know
to.
They've got to have them by April because the World Series is coming there.
Right.
But I'm not sure what's going to happen. But, I mean, that's a heck of a system for the IRS, you know, that everything's
sure.
logged in and categorized and, you know, there's no way around it. But I'm not sure how they'll do that. It's interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we've talked a little bit about the difference between hobby and professional, and I think a lot of our listeners aspire to play at a professional level, whether they'll ever become a poker pro or not. But if they want to claim poker professional as their occupation on their tax return, what documentation is required to do that, and what benefits would they get for doing so?
The only thing is they'll fill out something called a Schedule C, which basically is something you fill out when you have your own business. And they'll put on there, you know, gambling is the industry. And the biggest difference is you can't be doing anything else if you are a professional poker player. So, like I said, it's different from any other industry. I can't work at a bank during the day and then every single weekend go to Vegas and play as a pro. You can't do that. They basically, the IRS says you have to quit your day job and do this 100%. Completely,
really?
Just playing poker to be a pro.
So you can't have a part-time job?
Nope.
Wow.
Wow. That was really stupid. But then, if you want to try to, let's say that this is all I do. Well, am I professional? I'm a hobby. You kind of can look at it, how you're conducting it. You know, if you want to be a pro, if you're taking a lot of trips, if you're driving to casinos, if you're staying in hotel rooms, if you're taking out other players and talking about, you know, over a meal about how to do things and how to better things, or buying magazines and books and learning and all that, then you probably want to be a pro because there's a couple advantages. Number one, you can write off all these expenses, like your hotels, which you cannot do as a hobby. And number two, you know, if you want to plan for retirement, by having your own business, whether it's poker or anything else, you can put a lot of money away for retirement and reduce your tax bill, which you cannot do if you're a hobby. You can't use that hobby income to start putting money away in retirement.
So let me ask you, when you're telling me that you can't, like, say, get a part-time job, does that also mean that all of your investments and all of your side things have to be gambling-related?
Those things you're not physically doing. You know, let's say I've got a lot of stock, and I've got this huge stock portfolio, and I have a stockbroker that takes care of it, and I'm earning interest and dividends. That doesn't count because you're not physically doing it.
Okay.
You've got to look at how many hours you're spending. And so if I'm going, you know, at night working at Subway, you know, doing sandwiches, then I'm spending my time doing something else. Whereas if you're earning interest and dividends, you're basically, it's mailbox money. You're just sitting there and somebody else is doing the work and you're making money.
Well, what about if you were sponsored by Subway and you were their spokesperson or something, instead of not sponsored, but you were their spokesperson and you had to go do commercials for them, but you're popular because you're the world champion of poker? Does that, because of who you are and because of the professional part of it, made you that popular person, it's okay to do those sponsorship deals?
Yeah, that's not an easy answer.
Okay.
That can go either way. I mean, I've got clients that do that, and we just put it all under the gambling, you know, marketing.
Okay.
Because it's all part of the same industry.
Okay.
So that's a tricky one. But, my argument is that this is all, I would not have this if I didn't have the gambling professional part of it.
Okay.
And a lot of times the IRS would rather you be a professional gambler, because when you file that way, you have to pay self-employment tax. So they really make more money off of you as a professional poker player.
Man. Can't catch a break.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I have to go out of the country to play online poker. There's no breaks anymore.
All right, well, thank you for joining us today, Ann Margaret. Before we let you go, are there any basic questions we forgot to ask, or any last-minute advice for our listeners on anything tax-related with their card playing?
Not that I can think of, but and this isn't a plug for me. This is just a common-sense thing. Don't think you can do your own tax return if you're doing poker. You will inevitably make a mistake that you're going to pay a lot more money to have somebody fix. Just try to seek somebody that understands what's going on. Pay them the several hundred dollars to help you out, and at least you have somebody that's looked at it. You know, don't think just because you can play poker you can do tax returns.
Okay, well, you know, in that same vein, then, remind our listeners where they can go for more information on your services.
I have two websites. The first one is pokerdeductions.com, and you can email me from there. And then my CPA firm, which is in North Atlanta, is johnstoncpas.com. So either site you can get a hold of me, and I'm always happy to answer questions. If they're not too complicated, email me, and I'll be glad to answer any questions for anybody.
Excellent. Of course, they can always see your column in the archives of what you've written for us, so we really appreciate you doing that for us. It's a great service for our readers.
You're welcome.
Thanks for joining us today, Margaret.
All right. Thanks a lot, guys.
All right. Take care.
When you're alone and life is making you lonely, you can always go downtown.
This is Downtown Chad Brown, and I'm in the studio with Ante Up.
All right, it's a game that never dies, Chris.
Okay.
Six card hold'em will be our feature game for Hand of the Week here. Again, and who knew? We got this very innocent email from one of our listeners many months ago saying, hey, we play this crazy game in our home game. Next thing you know, we're talking about how much we love it on the show. We're playing it in our own home game, talking about how much we love it. And then a game breaks out on the Annie of Poker Cruise, and those people love it, except for the dealers. And now one of those hands from the cruise ends up on the show, so we're continuing to talk about Six Card Hold'em.
Well, it's a great game.
All right, so it comes from Richard Malatesta, who we took to calling Min Cash Rich on the last cruise, since he cashed in every tournament, just barely. But hey, you know, hey, if you can cash in every tournament, just barely.
Just a quick little side note, his last name means headache.
Does it really?
Yeah, so I have a feeling I'm going to have a headache from this hand.
Well, it is six-card hold'em.
Yeah, so it's pretty appropriate.
all right, so what I kind of like about this, I mean, we're not going to go crazy with six-card hold'em hand, so, I mean, this might be a one-and-done for a totem, but what I like about it is it's not just the play of the hand that you get to discuss. It's how you set your hand. It's kind of like a combination of Chinese poker and Omaha.
Right.
In a lot of ways, right? And that was the first decision that Min Cash Rich here had in his. He said, with so many hand combinations, it's an extremely loose, passive game with much limping, and we're pretty much getting five or six players to the flop, and they were playing six-handed, so almost family pot. That's what we kind of experienced in our home game, right?
Yeah. Let me ask you a question. I can't remember. Did you say if it was no limit, though?
No, they were playing 3-6 limit.
Oh, it is? Okay, 3-6 limit. Okay.
Yep. And he said, really, what would a raising hand look like in this game? How about a folding hand? So before we get into the actual hand, I think those are some good questions. I mean, I thought about this, and I would think, and I'm curious, I haven't done any calculations on this because I don't know how to do math, but I would think a raising hand would be, if I know I have two of my three hands are strong enough for me to raise with and hold them, that's probably a strong enough hand for me to raise with in six card. Is that fair or not?
You know, I don't know. I'm sorry. I just don't know. I can't even say it's fair or not. I feel like I'm never going to raise in this game, ever. It's almost like when we play double flop hold'em, where when somebody raises, we all in unison say, you're raising in double flop? Because no one's going to fold, and if they don't fold, they're all getting the right odds to draw out on you with six cards in their hand now. I don't know. I don't know. Yeah, do I want two double-suited ace hands with maybe a pair of eights in the other hand or something? Yeah, I'd love to have that hand. Do I want to raise with it? Yeah, I just have a feeling by the end of the hand I'm not going to win unless something happens, and I don't want to have to put more money out there just to give them more money to draw to their suited connector. You know, I don't know.
All right, well, how about his next question? How about a folding hand? Are there any...
Yes.
There is. Okay.
Yeah, there are folding hands, because if I have, like, deuce, seven, queen, you know, 8-4... you know, whatever, three, you know what I mean? And there's like four suits in there and only one is suited, you know, because you got three diamonds or something. I'm definitely folding that hand. If I don't have any kind of a nut hand or pairs or something, or if I only have one good hand out of the three, I can definitely see myself folding. I did fold when we played it a couple of times.
Yeah, but you're the tightest person I've ever met.
I'm not that tight.
No, I would say, I mean, if it is a limping, no one raising game, it'd be hard pressed to fold any hand. There's going to be some combination that works there. Now, if it's a game where I know there's a lot of raising and three betting, I certainly don't want to spend a small fortune speculating on a crappy hand. But it's hard for me to believe with six cards, you couldn't come up with at least one combination that has some good potential.
I know, but you're taking two cards to a six-card fight. And also, you're taking two cards, if you're playing five-handed, to a 30-card fight. Yeah, and it's just crazy.
You can have Jack 10 as two of your cards and have a nut straight, and if they're suited, you know, a nut royal draw just on that one card.
Oh, jeez.
That one set.
Yeah, let's keep calling six-card hold'em, okay? I want to keep playing against you.
Jeez. Well, you know, if you start raising, then I'm going
to
tighten up.
Yeah, that's true, too. Make it $9 to go. You might fold your Jack 10.
All right, well, let's move on to the hand here. He says, this particular hand was pretty typical, and then we ended up being a family pot with all six players seeing the flop for one small bet. I was in middle position with ace-ace.
Wait. I'm losing you. Say it again. Ace.
I was in middle position with ace-ace, king, 9-7 tray, with three spades, including one of the aces.
All right, so he had a suited ace of spades,
Yes. Basically
is all he had.
Yeah, and it was the ace and the tray that were suited as spades.
Okay.
So his first question is, how would you set the hand?
I'd probably have ace-king together, ace of spades, three of spades together, and 7-9 together.
That is exactly what he did. He said his first instinct was to set his hand with pocket aces as one combination, but he said with so many people seeing the flop, I decided to set the hand as you just did.
But I do have to interrupt. If the king is a spade, I wouldn't have done that.
Ah, because you're losing one.
Yeah, because I know I have the nut flush with the king of spades and the three of spades, so I might keep the aces together if the king was a spade.
Yeah, I think I actually might have said that to him, too, as well,
okay.
Too, because that way he gives you a flush there, and then you've got the high pair.
Yeah, because I know I have the nut flush too with the king, because I have the ace in my hand.
But I think that what's interesting is when you start to play this game, if folks out there are crazy enough to start playing at home, is that that instinct does take over. You're like, oh, I got pocket aces. Pocket aces are always great, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, not so much. You know, because again, you're right. You know, as much as you're mocking me for wanting to go to a fight with the two-card hand when everybody else has 3 2-card hands, you know, you don't want to neuter your other two hands here. In this particular one, if you have the pocket aces, what do you leave yourself with?
Yeah.
You got to leave yourself, you probably got to still pair the 9 and the 7, so you have a straight possibility, and then you have a king tray, which is almost worthless.
Yeah.
So by doing it this way, you've got 3 legitimate hands that have flopping potential here.
You know what I think we need to invent 6-card crazy hold'em.
Ooh.
Then after the flop, you can mix your cards up once you discard.
What if you have to pass one of your hands?
Pass a hand to the guy on the left.
Then you can say, hey, I know this guy here plays anything. I heard Scott on the podcast. He'll play any 2 cards. I'm going to give him this crap, and he's probably going to play it.
That's hilarious.
All right, so again, to remind our listeners, he did set his hand as the ace of spades, tray of spades, and then ace king offsuit and 9-7 offsuit. And the flop came 10-9-4 with 2 spades. And okay. It was checked around to us. Check or bet?
I'll bet and throw away the ace king. Why not? I got middle pair, backdoor draws, and nut flush draw.
Yeah, and this is where you can start to see how frustrating this game gets, because it's only in this universe where ace king is terrible.
Yeah.
And you want to throw it away to keep your 9-7. But yeah, you're right. You got to open end straight. That's what you wanted. That's part of the advantage of this game, is that you've got a lot of different combinations. And of course, you got to play for the spades, too. But what's funny is you're throwing away your best hand right now. Yeah. If you did the whole NFL Sunday Night in America, if the season ended today, the Packers would be NFC North champions. But the season never ends that day. It's never ended that day. And his hand's never going to end, so now you're throwing away your best hand.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the best hand of the three, but you still have a pair of 9s. So, but I know what you mean. The best of the 3 pairings.
Well, you don't have a pair of 9s.
Yeah, didn't you say it was 10-9-4?
10-8-4.
Oh, shoot. Sorry. Well, then I'm definitely keeping the 7-9 because it's an open-end draw. I thought you said it was 10-9-4. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
so I'm still getting rid of the ace-king, though.
Right, okay, good.
I thought you said it was 10-9-4. Okay, so yeah. All right, so good. Get rid of the ace-king. Did he get rid of the ace-king?
Well, no. He hasn't decided whether he's checking or betting yet.
Oh, I'm betting. What the hell? I'm open-ended. I got 6 outs there, plus I got every spade, and on top of it, my ace might be good if I hit it because I threw away an ace, so, you know, maybe there's not even an ace out, so...
Yeah, the frustrating thing about this thing is obviously this is a hand worth betting, I think. But unlike Omaha, where you're going to have those outs twice, you're only going to have those outs once.
Yeah.
Because after the next, when the turn comes, you got to decide whether you're going for the straight or the flush.
Yeah.
If you haven't already got there in one of them.
Yeah, exactly. So when the turn comes, if it's a spade, obviously we know what we're doing. But if it's like a 3, we're keeping the ace 3. If it's like a... That's the thing. I would always keep the flush draw, I think. And I know what's going to happen probably in a turn here. We're going to pair one of the 9s or 7s cards, I have a feeling. But I don't know. Yeah, I'm definitely getting rid of the ace-king. I'm definitely betting and seeing what happens. And then on the turn, I'll reassess. But if I don't hit either of them, I'm keeping the ace-3 because the ace is a high card, and I got more outs to a flush than I do to a... Although, it's actually the same on outs because we knew we threw a spade away, right? But we don't have a spade because we had 3 in our hands. So
there's one less spade, yes.
But a nut flush could be better than, you know, than a straight. So I think I would still keep the flush given the aces in my hand. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. I'm betting.
All right, good. We're all in agreement. Our hero bets out as well, too. He gets 4 callers, and he does, as we all do, pitches the ace king.
Okay.
The turn is a queen.
Oh.
And the other gun player bets out. One player folds, and it's back to us. Raise, fold, or call?
I'm going to call and go for... Because now we don't even have the nuts if we make our straight with the 9-7. So I'm going to make the call, because there's a lot of money out there with all those people calling.
Sure.
And I'm going to throw away the 9-7, because that way I'll have still a nut flush draw. Maybe my ace could still be good, given that... Other aces, if there were any out, might have gotten out of the hand by now. I could hit my ace on the end and it could still be good. Or I could hit make my flush and know it's good. So, yeah, I'm going to get rid of the 9-7 and call.
All right, well, our hero decides to call with his draws, but he wonders perhaps I should have raised to get the players behind me out.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was thinking that it was just him and the last person. I didn't realize there were still people who could call. I still wouldn't have raised, I don't think. Yeah, I still wouldn't have raised, but I wasn't thinking about that. For some reason, I was thinking he was last to act. Okay, I still am just calling, though.
I mean, I think at this point, this is the whole classic, what are you trying to accomplish by raising? You know, the whole push and pull thing. Are you trying to push people out of the pot, or are you trying to pull people into the pot so you make more money when you hit? And with our hand here, I'm really hoping that I hit my straight or flush, whichever I decide to go for. And if that happens, I want more people in the pot. And I'm not trying to drive people out, because there's probably no way we're going to win if we don't hit something here. Even if we hit the ace, I'm not real confident I'm going to win here. So at this point, I actually want more people in the pot, hope that I hit, and then I make a lot more money that way.
Yeah, and I don't want to... I realize that the betting is still open behind me because there's people still left to act, but I don't want to give the person who bet out another chance to bet if I can avoid it, because that person could very easily have Jack-9.
Yeah.
I mean, why wouldn't he have Jack-9? You know, because Jack-9 is open-ended too on that flop, so that's why he could have called, and now he's hitting his bet out because he wants to protect his hand against the spades. So I don't want to give him another chance to make it another bet and make me pay that much more to try to hit my hand, so I'm just calling.
All right, so he says two players call behind him, so we have four players left going to the, he says the turn, but that's the river. He says he puts the under-the-gun player on pocket queens. He suddenly liked his hand, though I think you're right, he could suddenly like his hand with the straight.
Yeah.
Well, too, right? And the players behind him, he said, could have a lesser flush draw or underset, or perhaps the same straight draw I had. Now I had a decision. Do I pitch the flush draw or the straight draw? What would you do?
Well, again, I mean, our straight draw is not even a nuts now. And it seems like we're going to have to... If we threw the flush draw away, he just said that players behind him could have a lesser flush draw. So if our flush gets there, now what if, let's just say, the Jack of Spades comes, you know, or something, and we threw it away, and we make our straight, but it's not the nuts anymore. You know what I mean? Or whatever. Now someone else has a flush, and we don't have the nut. We threw the nuts away rather than having the second best straight or whatever it is. So there's no way I'm keeping my straight draw here. What's going to make me sick is the river is going to be like the eight of spades, and it's going to pair the board. And you know that's what's going to happen because it's hand of the week. But and I have no idea what this hand is. I don't have it. I have no idea. So it just feels like that's going to happen. But I'm definitely keeping the spade draw. Why would I want to keep a second nut draw when I have a nut draw for the same outs?
Well, excellent. I'm glad you went there because he disagrees with you. And okay. He decided to pitch the flush draw, and he said, here's why. One, since I had a third spade, I only had eight outs to the flush, the same number as outs as for the straight. Two, if the flush came, it was a more obvious made hand, but I hoped that the straight making it would be more deceptive.
At this point, first of all, I disagree with that in so many ways. But the main reason is that if your straight gets there now, you're going to have four to a straight on the board, essentially. There's going to be so many straights that everyone's going to see it anyway. Two, you're drawing to something that's not the nuts now. Three, oh, I hate those obvious hands that win me the pot. Oh, that just drives me crazy. I'd hate to win a pot, obviously. I mean, really, who cares that you made your flush? I want to win the money that's out there now. Whether they can tell I have a flush or not, you're not going to break anybody. It's not like it's Nolan and Hold'em are going to get their whole stack with this deception.
And I think that's key, too, is that, I mean, how many times do you play a low limit game where you just are convinced that the guy hit his flush when
exactly.
He comes there? I mean, he even may make it clear to you. He might have stand up and do the rain dance. And you know that he got there. But it's one more bet. It's $6. Just in case that he's blind and misread his hand or something. You're still going to get value out of that flush, I think. And if not, you're right. You're going to win. So.
Right. And, you know, on top of it, too, limit. Everyone knows when you're playing limit, it's a drawing game. So you're sitting there looking for the draws. That's what you do when you play Limit Hold'em. You're like, what hand am I protecting here, or what hand am I protecting against, or whatever. And everyone looks at that straight and flush possibility that comes on the river or the turn. So it's no, you can't tell me that when those two spades were on that board and you bet and everyone called, that people weren't thinking to themselves, someone's on a draw here. They can't all have a set because there's only three cards on the board. You know what I mean? So it's to me, to worry about that and Limit Hold'em is you need to be worried about other things, like playing six-card Hold'em.
All right, so the river was a red jack for a final board of 10-8-4 queen jack. And our hero makes a straight, but now realizes what Chris realized earlier, because the queen, my straight is not the nuts.
Yeah, I mean, ace-king is the nuts now. And on top, and you threw ace-king away.
Yeah, and he said, I hit runner-runner to the first hand I had pitched. What a game! The end of the gun checks to the any nine, makes a straight board, and now it's up to us. What do we do?
I'm checking, because, I mean, we have the worst straight possible. So if somebody calls, then fine. I mean, somebody bets, I mean, then fine, I'll just call and be happy if I split it with somebody. But really, I mean, you know, if you kept your aces together, you would have had king nine, and you still would have had the straight, but, you know, whatever, to the king this time. But I'm not betting here, because I don't even have the close to the nuts. I have, like, the second to worst straight to possible, right? I mean,
You got the shell of the acorn.
Yeah, yeah, so I'm getting rid of this. I'm not going to put any money in unless it's just a call.
All right, so our hero says, with four of us in the hand, I couldn't bet. I had resolved to call any single bet and fold. Perhaps I'm stubborn to a bet and a raise. But it went check, check behind me, and I ended up splitting the pot with the buttons 10 of spades, 9 of spades.
Yeah.
A worse flush draw who backed in the same straight. Yeah. This is a bizarre game. I like it.
It is a cool hand. It does make you think a lot. I'm not necessarily how this will help your Hold'em game. I like to think when we play Omaha, it helps your Hold'em game, helps your focus. But this game probably is a little more frustrating than focus. But
well, it does make you think about outs and the strength of hands. I mean, again, this is one of those things that we teach in Poker 101 too. Is you don't always want your hand to improve.
Right.
You want other people's hands to improve just enough that yours is better. You know. So if you've already got a made straight in Omaha, and you've got flush cards, but they're not the nut flush, you don't want to get that flush, even though your hand's better, because it becomes weaker.
Yeah.
And I think this game forces you to think about that, and particularly this particular situation here. Am I better off going for a straight or a flush? Normally, obviously, the flush is where you'd want to go with, and I think in this hand, I think probably still made sense to do that, even though we split the pot with our straight, but that, I think, is where the advantage in helping your Hold'em game comes in this.
Yeah, because let's face it, if you're given two situations and they both have the same amount of outs, but one of them's a nuts and one of them isn't, why wouldn't you go for the nuts? So it kind of confused me that he didn't go for it. I mean, he paid off for him, half the pot. But
half paid off.
Yeah, half paid off. But just kind of confounds me that he would do that.
All right, Rich, we're going to send you a deck of J-Design playing cards, official playing cards of Anti-Up. You can pick up your own decks in the Anti-Up store at antiupstore.com. And they do work with six-card Hold'em. We've tried it. And everybody else, remember to send your hands of the week to podcast@antiupmagazine.com. Send your call to the floors, questions, complaints, all kinds of other stuff there, too. And if we use it on the show, we'll send you some great stuff.
Want to thank our good friend Ann Margaret Johnson for answering all of our tax questions today. She was really good, and we appreciate her being on the show and writing for us. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the tables.
Anti Up is a production of AntiUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AntiUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AntiUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.